Right, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm Dr. Laura Roman. I'm CMO of EdgeX. I will be moderating over the next hour, and we're going to delve into digital twins and traffic management. The broader context of this topic is Industry 4.0 and how we're moving toward an automated future. We've got an esteemed, amazing set of panelists and a lot to cover. So let's get started with some introductions. Jeff, starting with you.
My name is Jeff Decoe, chairman of the Autonomy Institute. We're focused on bringing intelligent and autonomous infrastructure and systems to market to make impact in society. Very similar to what manufacturing has been able to take advantage of a lot of automation. We see a tremendous amount of impact in our own lives if that was actually brought out into the public domain.
Hi, Patricia Baumhardt. I'm an emerging tech strategist, executive advisor, and team member. Some areas I've worked in recently include cybersecurity, intelligent infrastructure, quantum computing, and water tech. My work is powered by an intense curiosity about emerging tech and the applications and how it impacts how we live, how we learn, how we work and advance research for good. It's exciting. And it's a privilege to be able to see the macro view and connect the dots and connect organizations, going leveraging work experience that goes all the way back to my work studying for an MBA at Harvard.
Knight.
Knight Keys. My company is Eagle Lake Development, and what we focus on primarily is public-private partnerships. And for those of you who aren't familiar, public-private partnerships are really kind of a delivery model structure where you have public entities and private entities collaborating together in order to deliver projects and effectively operate businesses together. Because at the end of the day, you've got to have a source of funding, you've got to have a vision for what the project you're doing and trying to accomplish, and then you've got to really intensely collaborate together in order to deliver it all of the pieces.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll get into P3s in the course of this conversation. But let's start with some level-setting definitions. So Jeff, I would love for you to give us a sense, two things. What is Industry 4.0 in your mind? And then two, what is a digital twin?
Well, I think Industry 4.0 is a lot like the digital twin. It has a lot of interpretation from the different people. But we put it in the context of If the first industrial revolution was all about steam engines and machines, and the second was electricity and what communication networks allowed us as a society to do, and we'd say the last 40 years, 50 years has been around the digital age, which is leveraging incredible inventions of famous people like Metcalf, allowing us to connect, network, and process data. This next Industry 4.0 is about the bridging of the physical and the digital worlds together, because we're seeing that the technology is coming up it's up close and personal to us now. And that is all going to be about automation and about how data can be leveraged in a highly beneficial way to society.
Yeah, that's great. And again, we'll get into this 1 trillion connected devices by 2025 and the tsunami of data and how we're going to make sense of that data. So the next thing is, what is a digital twin? You talk in conversation about digital twin as the killer app of the edge. What do you mean by that?
Well, digital twin is, once again, I always have to say that it means a lot to different people. I mean, if you're in advanced manufacturing, it means you're having a digital twin of your turbine. Our interpretation of digital twin is much broader, because it actually impacts many, many use cases in many different industries. And it's about creating a replica of not just a device, not just a piece of equipment, but of an entire city. And how can that actually be leveraged to the benefit of all the people and communities that live within that city? And to that, just for the audience to know, seems that we're in Austin. Austin is going to become the first city-scale digital twin in the United States. Believe it or not, there is no digital twin at a city scale anywhere in the United States, and City of Austin has a tremendous amount of partners that are gonna come in and actually provide that building, and that is gonna help things like Cap Metro better plan bus routes and how they're going to incorporate technology. It's gonna allow advanced planners to water networks and data networks across the city. It really does have dozens of different use cases.
Yes, right. And again, the rest of the focus here will be not just traffic management, but transportation generally. But you touched on something, which is getting into the smart city, what that means, and specifically intelligent infrastructure. So I think it would be good to, again, level set with what intelligent infrastructure is and how digital twins are tied to intelligent infrastructure.
And the intelligent infrastructure was what led us to the digital twin being the, quote, the killer app, because it was a killer app for how we were going to incorporate intelligent infrastructure within the city of Austin and down some of the highways that we were working with. The way we see intelligent infrastructure is put in a context of, I think all of us have seen radio towers across the city. You know, the city of Austin has about a dozen radio towers, and we've all seen cell towers that provide this incredible service to our phones and allows us to move around the city effectively and do things without having to be connected with wires. Intelligent infrastructure is a component of this new infrastructure that has to go into a city that supports advanced sensors and things like 5G, 6G, and advanced services that will basically make the city more effective, more responsive, and really meet the community needs moving forward.
So if we think about this, where are we in this conversation in terms of actually seeing intelligent infrastructure in action, and what are some conduits or barriers, or what is the path for that? And this might get a bit into the P3 conversation.
Yeah, so when we started pursuing this now almost 5 years ago, we did not even know there was a challenge of getting this next level, this dense networks to basically support automation. Our original pursuit was how can we get, delivery robots, to deliver people's, groceries to their homes, or shuttles to pick up grandma, take her to the doctor and back home, or just advance and optimize mobility so we don't have to keep on building more lanes because we're optimizing the way cars move around the city. All that requires additional sensors to be put into the city, and that was what put us front and center where this infrastructure has to go is on easements that are owned primarily by city, state, and federal government. So this is what led us, luckily, we had a very large partner, Gensler, introduce us to Knight Keys 2.5 years ago, because once you understand the challenge of this digital infrastructure and knowing that you have to establish P3s, you have to understand how that process and how that enablement's gonna take place.
So before we get more into P3s, actually, I want to step back and just talk about infrastructure. So you talk about the public infrastructure network node. We have a picture of it in the slides that you have. I think it would be great to show everyone like what this kind of infrastructure can look like, or if not, describe what it is.
Well, I'll describe what it's not going to be. So if anybody's been walking around the city of Austin, you'll see traffic poles wrapped with really unattractive steel boxes. So that is what the world that we live in today. The PIN, Public Infrastructure Network Node, was a new standard that was developed amongst dozens of industry partners that will create a nice, elegant new asset class that will get deployed within the city. So today you see silver boxes at every intersection. You see multiple carriers and multiple cameras, all kinds of devices strapped, bolted, and attached all over our city. In the future, all that's going to be blended into a nice, elegant condo that everything just disappears in. What that was going to do is it's going to allow us to be far more advanced with the compute in our infrastructure and the type of services that can be delivered. But it's also going to be a challenge about how these P3s get built up and allow us this technology to be deployed.
Okay, that makes sense. So then delving more into P3s, what are some examples of P3 relationships now that whatever you can say or share, but how do you see P3s as, you said in conversation, the game changer toward enabling this infrastructure, even tied to the larger government bill that we have with $1 trillion towards infrastructure, but maybe tell us a bit more about P3s and how they're the path to this, fulfilling
this. Well, it's the path, and that's why I think it's really incredible to have Knight here to talk about it, because in the United States right now, we have $1.2 trillion that have been allocated for new infrastructure across the United States to be built out. We also have an unprecedented amount of private capital, like hundreds of billions of dollars that will underwrite this new infrastructure, but it requires a P3 to be established. You can't just go into a city and throw down 2,500 pins across the city. You actually have to work with the city, you have to work with the community, and you have to work with other city leaders to get it deployed. But this is where I think there's a tremendous amount of insight that Knight has on P3s.
Yeah, and in a second we'll get into traffic, transportation, and P3s as the conduit for getting us closer to Vision Zero and things that are the thrust of the panel. But I want to talk for a second about the timing. Obviously, we've got this infrastructure now, this infrastructure bill in place, but this is really imperative, right? So tell us more about the why now. And this is partly in context of, you know, obviously in thinking about this panel, going through lots of stats and reports, and there's a report on smart cities and rankings, and San Francisco, for example, falling from being an exemplary smart city, 11th to 60 now in terms of the smart cities index. So we see that we're not in short keeping up with other parts of the world, the pace. Like we are behind in the infrastructure race. This is really urgent. So maybe you can tell us more about, from your perspective, why now and how we can.
Well, it is urgent. Unfortunately, I think that it's the top 50 list of the smart cities. There's not a single U.S. city actually that qualifies to be on that list. You know, China. It's amazing to see that they've kind of built New York over almost 20 times. So they've implemented the largest rail systems, the largest road systems, and have a tremendous amount of intelligent systems. They have 1.2 million 5G nodes, as an example, deployed. We have about 35,000 here in the United States. So I think it is an imperative, but also it's unprecedented time here in the United States. We have unbelievable engineers and scientists that have actually built so many of these enabling technologies that can be deployed. And if we solve the economics about how to build out, we'll be able to see something really at scale. And we've been working for the last 2 years on what we call an Intelligent Infrastructure Commerce Act that basically patterns after the 1956 interstate highways. And it might be, a lot of people might question, but we have not actually seen a national infrastructure build out that has occurred since the 1956 interstate highways. And we're about to see one now because of all this edge infrastructure that will end the digital divide, basically allow us to reach Vision Zero and start to automate a lot of the services around us.
That's great, and I think that this is a good time then to transition over to Unite and to get into the heart of this conversation around digital twin and not just traffic management, but transportation at large. So again, a stat from a report that the U.S. Department of Transportation issued a couple of months ago. Last year, 2021, we had over 40,000 traffic fatalities. This is the highest in the past 50 years. You would think it's kind of antithetical to the fact that we were mostly in lockdown. But that's a documented stat. So Knight, would love to hear from you a bit more about if you can describe the future of transportation, explain the role of digital twins, and kind of give us more in-depth info on the P3 approach to unbottling this and getting to Vision Zero.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think really kind of the hot topic in transportation right now is autonomous vehicles. And we have lots of companies out there innovating, coming up with new ideas for how to solve the problem for autonomous vehicles. And the reality is we already live in a world of autonomous vehicles. Right now, today, transportation is all about autonomous vehicles. They're already here. They happen to be carbon-based intelligence. And so with that, we have all kinds of traffic problems. We have all kinds of traffic challenges. And so when it comes to kind of leaping over to what we try to think of as autonomous vehicles, which in essence is about robots and robots operating in our physical environment, the big leap that comes out, the translation point for that, is a digital twin. You think about the most widely deployed robot right now is the Roomba. And when you have a Roomba in your house and you turn it loose to do its job, to do its work, incidentally, we have a Roomba at our house. His name's Harry because we've got a German Shepherd. and Harry goes to work every night. And when he goes around the house, he's bumping into walls. He's got little sensors on him. But when he finishes, you pull up the app and he's got a little map. And that is a digital twin. And when we talk about autonomous vehicles or robots working in our physical environment, they have to have a translation, a point of reference. And every single autonomous vehicle out there right now is attempting to do the same thing on its own in a vacuum, which is the exact same thing our carbon-based autonomous vehicles are working today. And what happens when we merge the two and put them out, turn them loose into our built cities? The exact same thing. The exact same congestion, the exact same challenge. So really the key to it has to do with building better systems. And so when we talk about the broader vision of a digital twin and intelligent connected infrastructure, we're talking about all of the pieces that make up traffic as we talk about it. So it's the vehicles, it's the weather, it's the pedestrians, it's the bikes, it is the entire cityscape. And the thing about a digital twin and that little map that the Roomba makes, that works very well for the Roomba. Harry's very happy with his map, but when you actually pull it up and look at it, every night it's different, and it's not entirely accurate, and it doesn't actually look like the footprint of my house. It's riddled with areas because he doesn't have the same points of reference that can be brought to bear by an integrated system. So when we talk about like the vision for larger scale digital twins, it has to do with federated data, and it has to do with translating for the robot in space, in time, the precise points of reference that allow them to orient themselves, to decide how to respond, and then to act on that. And in a way, we have that in the carbon system, but in the carbon system, everybody's in their own bubble, and they're responding in very, very different ways. And when we go about trying to design robots to fill that role, they're still living in their own bubble. And it's very difficult to translate that. But if we take that out of the point of reference and then really do what robots do well, which is connect within a larger integrated system, then we're talking about all modes of transportation. We're talking about solving all of the different challenges for how do you come up with a algorithm to predict, you know, the guy that gets his shoelace caught in his crank on the bike and falls off, or the ball that bounces in the road. It's more akin to large-scale traffic management, not unlike what we do with air traffic control. Coming back to the digital twin, when you go to look at the way each one of these autonomous vehicles is out there running around creating its own digital twin, the idea that we can then take that data and federate it together to create a much more rich dimensional picture, once you create all that in one stack, you can then slice it in a whole bunch of different ways to create all new applications and all new sets of data that solve challenges like city maintenance, like first responder. And then you're talking about a system that can now work together collaboratively to solve the challenges of travel, of transportation and traffic, and then getting to Vision Zero, which is, for those of you that don't know, Vision Zero was started up in the early 90s in Sweden. And it's the concept that we can eliminate all traffic-related fatalities and major injuries if we just work together on integrated systems to alleviate the risks that come along with that. So I'll pause there for a second.
It's great, very rich. I think to summarize this, can we think of this as you've got a constantly shifting, changing point of reference, and a digital twin helps to kind of rectify or remedy that point of reference in real time.
So exactly.
It's a constant moving target that's constantly at the same time through a digital twin being remedied in real time, so you have an accurate point of reference. Is that a good summary?
That is a good summary. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then going back to systems, and I think this is, again, an age-old question in the people, process, technology, the people side, people, for example, I'm not going to take this to the cyber realm, but people click on phishing emails, the people, the human fallibility. And I know we had our Secretary of Transportation here earlier in the week, Pete Buttigieg, and he says, of course, people make mistakes, but human mistakes don't have to be lethal. In a well-designed system, safety measures make sure that human fallibility does not lead to human fatalities. So thinking about how we systematize traffic and how that can be even like in one vertical or a microcosm of systematizing moving vehicles, transport generally. So you, again, you have a constant real-time accurate point of reference. How do you see P3s fitting into this? Again, like, why is that important toward this path to autonomy ultimately, Industry 4.0?
Yes, so that's a great question. And I think that that really, as Jeff mentioned, is really kind of the crux of it, is the P3 approach to things. So a public-private partnership, or P3, really, it's a creature of contract, meaning you fit together sets of contracts among public entities, private entities, to allow them to collaborate and allow them to do what it is that they do best. And there's all kinds of different aspects of what that may be in each different situation. But when it comes to traffic, and particularly when it comes to the digital twin, what we're talking about here, and I'll go back to Harry again, is Harry creates his own map, and the trick with the digital twin to make it effective for transportation is it's got to be geo-rectified, meaning it has to be accurate and precise both to a reference point in the physical environment. And as you said, this can be a point that changes over time. As we walk down, particularly on a day like today, if you walk down Fifth Street right now, you have an incredible amount of things that are going on that don't follow the rules of traffic. You've got all kinds of improvisation, and that all becomes very, very complex. But if you were to take all of, let's just assume that this is all being done by silicon-based autonomous vehicles, they're running around creating their digital twins. You also have city resources that are monitoring traffic, monitoring timing, collecting other points of data. And I go back to an example we talked about the other day, an invention from Walt Disney about that created animation. And I liken this to the structure of a public-private partnership, is that what he was trying to solve for was to give more depth of animation. And the way they would go about doing that was they would start to paint or draw onto glass plates the different layers of the background. And then they would come up a little bit higher and maybe some of the surrounding trees and the branches, and they would work up and then fit the characters. They put it all in glass, stack it up at different depths, and then mount a camera looking down. And when you do that, you get a fuller, richer illusion of depth, which has to do with, you know, the perception and how you perceive it, but you also create a whole picture. Now, if you were to take each one of those layers of glass and moving to the P3, different parties are collecting different elements of data. So how do you structure an agreement that allows you to get that top-down view? Because once you have that top-down view, you can then splice it out to do things like figuring out how much wear and tear is going on the street. You can do things like, back to traffic management, what's going on with the timing here of the traffic patterns, and can we adjust the broader system to alleviate that traffic? And then a third example is, and this is a big one with smart cities, is first responders. How do you alleviate traffic in times of emergency to allow first responders to arrive on the scene to transport people? As we know with first responders, the golden hour is crucial. And when you're talking about dense urban areas, not only are you talking about the transportation element of it, but you're also talking about porting resources to the scene to get what you need when you need it in order to have an effective response. So,
yeah, that's brilliant, very rich. And I think, again, if we just abstract this back up to, again, what this all means in terms of Industry 4.0, and I want to keep coming back to this as a North Star of sorts, because that term has a potential to get, you know, very trendy, buzzwordy. But I think, again, it's really, in short, you know, the pursuit of greater efficiency, automation, and autonomy at scale. And I think how this plays out in traffic transportation management and getting in place more of a system is a big step toward that. Again, I think this is interesting at scale. So I want to go back to you and then ask you, from your opinion and your perspective, before we turn into data and the tsunami of data and how we're going to make sense of that, but what are some barriers now to having a transportation system that works at scale, as it were, where you have kind of a system in place that's at scale?
So, and I'm circling back to a public-private partnership in the arrangement, You know, for a transportation system from a city or municipality or other agency that is responsible for this, and particularly here in Austin, you've got different agencies responsible for different segments of traffic, and they all combine together and overlap in some ways. But what you're talking about here is they've got a certain set of resources. And when it comes to a public-private partnership, oftentimes one of the resources brought to bear is private dollars and private investment. On the other side of that, in order to kind of justify the investment for, let's just say, a larger integrated system, you're going to talk about certain expertise that are available in the private sector. At the same time, the public responsibility for equity and design and layout and how to articulate how to balance the city, as we know because of the digital divide, is not something that can be left to just commercial profit. You know, the challenge we have with the digital divide is one of consumerism and capitalism. But when we're talking about traffic management and equity, and particularly when we're talking about wholesale transportation systems, you've got to be able to have a view that cuts across just the revenue lines, the commercial application lines. At the same time, the resources that are generated by, let's just say, the data collected by Uber drivers, the data collected by drone delivery companies, can be contributed into that system in ways that make it more resilient and that create a higher level of fidelity that then adds value to the larger scale transportation system. So it's all about structuring those parties together and bringing them together under one umbrella that allows them all to collaborate and contribute their resources in an equitable and agreeable way, while keeping the mission and the goal of a large-scale transportation system, when you don't have necessarily the resources to just go out and do it, to keep that vision, I'll say, intact or focused on where it needs to be from the perspective of city governments, municipal government support.
Yeah, that's great. I think, you know, this implication that digital twins and traffic management, transportation, and thinking of systems is about getting, you know, the right data to the right people, the right time for quicker collaboration, decision making in real time, and the thrust through this so far too is really data. This is a bigger conversation about data and the use of data and all the vectors into how we're using data, how we're like kind of splicing and dicing data in a way that makes it useful to us. And Patricia, it's a good moment to turn to you and to think about data. It's been said that data is the key resource of the 21st century. But again, for level setting, can you tell us, you know, textbook, what exactly is a data exchange?
Sure, great question, Laura. I did bring a textbook definition. So a data exchange is the process of taking data structured under a source schema and transforming it into a target schema so that the target data is accurate, an accurate representation of the source data. So data exchange allows data to be shared between different computer programs. So in essence, then, the digital twin becomes the data repository, the software stack for exchanging data in a secure way.
And then really the biggest thing about the data exchange and why it's different, because that textbook example of what data exchanges have been around for a long time. But what's different now is it's about our data. We don't want our data. We don't want cameras capturing our data. We don't want our license plates to go in places. So we're now talking about intimate data that we care about and that we want to control. And that's where the sovereignty of the data exchanges that are in the P3 are specific to our HOA, specific to our town, specific to our city, or even specific to the state. It's not just pumping all this data up into a cloud and wishing for the best. That data is going to be very, very localized, and it's only going to be able to be leveraged where that data is captured and where the rules of the data exchange allow. And that's why the public-private partnership is so key, is whoever the parties are that are involved with that P3 And if so, an investor comes in with private capital to pay, you know, $200 million to build out this intelligent infrastructure across the city of Boston, they are going to work with the community and the city, you know, departments on how do we, as a community, want our data treated. And this platform allows that to be done.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think a facet of this, too, we can say a bit more about is privacy at the sensor. So what does that mean for you? Can you define what that is first for everyone?
So there's some really good reports that have come out about privacy at the sensor, because we know the future of IoT and what we're already seeing within a lot of, you know, cities is the more rich we can make the data about situational awareness to allow pedestrians to stay safe. You know, we have a lot of cities that are deploying cameras and LIDARs and other sensors that see pedestrians and notify vehicles before something, you know, catastrophic occurs. The thing is that's a lot of rich data if it's not controlled in the right way. And privacy at the sensor is that you're only extracting out the twin of that environment. And all personal identifiable data is never recorded, never captured, never shared. And that's where the privacy at the sensor is. You might process a petabyte of data at a pin every single month, but what goes anywhere from that is very, very small, because you're not allowing any of that rich data to go back to a data center somewhere.
I mean, that starts to get into the whole edge discussion. So processing the data where it's being generated, having it actionable on the spot, and then what happens to the data that's not being used or isn't necessary? What happens to that data, the discardable data, as it were?
Yeah, most data is just gone. It's just recorded over as these systems. But I think it really also points out why we believe the digital twin is clearly the killer app that's going to occur at the edge. We have all these 5G companies, you know, the AT&T's, Verizon's, and T-Mobile's all talking about 5G. And usually what they tell us is we're going to be able to download our Netflix really, really fast. I don't think any of us has really, you know, thought about making sure we download, you know, 10 high definition, you know, movies before we go somewhere on a mobile device. But what it is activating machine to machine and activating a safer environment across the city in a more optimized. If all of a sudden our cars can be smarter, talk to each other, and we can actually have advanced transportation without actually building more lanes, that's a win for the environment. But it all comes down to latency and the amount of data. Because we're with 5G networks, you're talking about requiring low latency for speaking to a machine to machine or machine to a pedestrian. And then you're also talking about the amount of data. Like a single LIDAR or digital radar system at a single intersection can itself, you know, be, you know, terabytes of data per day. And you don't want that data to somehow try to find its way back to a data center.
So then linking that back to Vision Zero, what's the challenge now between reaching Vision Zero and data processing and latency, and without getting tuned to the whole edge and cloud discussion, but like what are the barriers to Vision Zero right now, and how quickly do you think that we could solve those challenges?
Well, I'd say that US DOT already had a plan even 20 years ago. They understood the problem. It was a systems, you know, problem they had to solve. So they came out with a technology called DSRC, which is another radio spectrum that was actually deployed that allowed cars to speak to each other. But that was what highlighted the challenge. They had the challenge because the economics for them to deploy that technology was far too great. That's why we don't have it. We went 20 years and we don't have DSRC except for little pockets across the US. But also it's the same challenge that 5G has, the same challenge that Edge has, is if you solve the P3 challenge, working with the city, working with the communities, you solve how the sensors can be deployed and how we can start seeing these rich services delivered to the communities.
And building on that, it's not just there are services that are going to be able to be provided by the cities, but also further down the line, there could be new sources of revenue. And that's where leaders like Jeff and Knight come in. The P3, and the city is actually part of that three. The community benefits from that revenue. So then that builds up the resiliency of the city. Okay. As opposed to it all going to big tech and then having them be not great stewards of our data.
Yes, and I would add to that in that, you know, kind of the the move, so, and I told Jeff this one time a while back, and it stuck with him, and he pulls it out every once in a while, because when we talk about P3s, and we talk about defining P3s, and how does it work, and let's talk about structure. I said, Jeff, if you've seen one P3, you've seen one P3. Every one of these things is a little bit unique, a little bit nuanced, but at the core, it is a public-private partnership, and it's always a public-private partnership, because when it becomes a P3, when it is a P3, it is a public challenge that's trying to be solved. And in this case, we're talking about the challenges having to do with transportation. But it just so happens that by solving this challenge of how are we going to deal with autonomous systems as they come along through traffic management, through transportation management, we look to a digital twin for how robots can operate in physical space. And that makes a lot of sense. But it's the challenge that the public entity is trying to solve. How are we going to deal with this? It just so happens that when you bring the digital twin into the equation, you also then looking at challenges such as the digital divide. You're talking about challenges such as how the city distributes its resources. You're talking about the challenges of, again, first responders, city services. You're talking about equity. You're talking about how the city itself operates in order to better serve its citizens in a more even, balanced, and equitable way. So the key point is that when we talk about a public-private partnership as the path to reconcile it, it is the challenge that we as a group, as a collective society, are going to tackle, which is how do we integrate all of this technology and all of these new systems in a way that the public has got to deal with. And I think that that's really at the heart of it, why the public-private partnership is the best way to go about it, because that gives you the goals and the reference for how we don't just slide off into some of the other challenges we're having with technology around privacy, around, you know, who owns this, who owns that, when at the end of the day, it's the public challenge that we're trying to solve.
Yeah, I'd even say a quick way of thinking about this too is breaking down silos. You think about like thematically or metaphorically this cross-disciplinary approach, right? So how do you get like neuroplastically get out of your rutter way of thinking, same thing, and how can public and private leverage each other? I think we see this thematically too, even like in business schools, to train someone to be a leader. There's leadership classes in leading business schools that, believe it or not, will pull in a conductor of an orchestra or even like a horse whisperer to can like thematically get out of that rutted way of thinking, neuroplastically in short. We've covered a lot of ground already. We still have some time. I think we're at about 40 minutes. So I'd love for us to get into some summary remarks and then leave some time for Q&A. And I think, Jonathan, before we were talking earlier, you've got a question. But let's try to make this kind of tidy, as it were, and also say, too, that this is the beginning of a very rich, integral conversation that we will be following up with in 6 weeks at the Intelligent Infrastructure Conference here in Austin. But going back to summarizing this, I think, Knight, let's start with you, again, thinking about a tidy way of thinking about these P3s and the path to them and how it's going to help solve the transportation problem.
Yeah, so I'll kind of go back real quick to what I was saying before in that, you know, transportation and traffic as a whole is a challenge that necessarily city governments, the agencies that are responsible for them, don't have the resources to tackle. And so they've got to turn to private industry. They've got to turn to private capital. They've got to reach out there, as you said, across the silos to figure out what resources that they can make available in order to tackle these challenges. And that's where a public-private partnership comes in. Kind of in addition to that, when you get into things like transportation, when you get challenges like city services and what the mission of the city is to its citizens, you get into things that are more complex systems. And the more complex the system, the more you need to be looking to who all you can bring in as partners, what resources can be brought to bear to solve those challenges. And I believe a public-private partnership is the way to bring all of those to bear for those challenges that the public is facing these days.
Yes. Patricia, what about data exchange and data? What's a summary for you and how that
Actually, what I'm most excited about is how this empowers communities to use that data for their benefit, and how autonomy can free up people's time to be to just apply their creativity in innovation. So it strengthens communities.
Jeff.
I'd say that the core focus that we're going to have is on intelligent infrastructure that enables things like the digital twin and enables the data exchange and allows communities to become far more resilient. And I would just, you know, the main thing that is going to happen is with all this money, we're talking about between the private industry and public, we're, you know, seeing almost $2 trillion over the next 10 years pumped into our cities and our towns. It's on us to basically collaborate and make sure that what is built is what the communities want to see, versus it being something that just is forced upon us.
Yeah, you know, in short, digital twins are going to help us move faster as a nation on bottleneck. We think about, we didn't go into all of the use cases, but when most of us think of it too, the NASA example and prototyping for NASA comes into mind. But I think with that, that's great. Let's turn to the audience. I think, Jonathan, you had a question, and then we're going to open it up. We've got a pretty good turnout here.
Hey, great job. Jeff, what I was thinking through is that here in Austin, we have the Air Force Innovation Command Actors, we have Army Futures Command, we have DOD's Innovation Command, DFU. But how can the PIN network specifically help looking through like military and other applications, technology organizations,
That's one of the main topics we've been trying to spend a lot of time on. So we have spent a lot of time with DOD over the last 4 years, because usually it's in the past, historically, it's DOD that's always brought us new innovations. In fact, historically, interstate highways was because of a DOD constraint and a concern. GPS, that basically all of us use pretty much on a daily basis, was a innovation from DOD. And then you think about the internet ourselves. I mean, we're now all been able to use the internet over the last 50 years robustly. And that was once again because of the R&D efforts of DOD. So we have, we did a memorandum of understanding or a partnership with Texas Military Department and Camp Mabry to deploy PINs on that campus with a sole purpose of leaning into what they want to see, which is the base of the future, which is a smart city, but for bases. And it's not about really defensive aspects, it's more about how they can make the soldier more effective, how they can actually make the community more responsive to the communities that they serve around them. So I think there's a lot of opportunity, and we're just always looking for ways to make that happen.
Cool. Hey, great talk. So I'm a data scientist. I've done digital twins and like some packaged goods, so I understand the whole, you need a lot of data, you need a lot of sensors, the more data you get, the more granular it is. Ultimately, the better model that you're going to have. But here, like going to Industry 4.0, we're seeing, I think we're saying we're getting from like the digital to like physical, and like we're merging into the. And we're thinking about like, R&D in some packaged good space. We can get as much data as we want and not infringing on like rights, privacy. I know you guys spoke about that a lot, and I appreciate it. So I guess like, my concern though is we've seen time and again, I actually like the public part, the P3. But time and again, this is both the public and the private sector here in the U.S. just broad kind of infringe on data rights, data ethics, things like this. So I guess, what specific checks and balances are being thought about or already implemented for just in terms of surveillance? I mean, I was online just kind of going on and on, but I guess you probably have something to talk about with that. So.
Well, no, I think you raise a great point. And that's definitely top of mind when it comes to what we're talking about with intelligent connected infrastructure. Is it does take a lot of sensors, a lot of data, a lot of things get vacuumed up, so to speak. And what are the safeguards having to do with that? And when it comes to a public-private partnership, that in essence becomes part of the check and balance of it, because that data then goes into a data exchange that is owned by an entity that has checks and balance built into it that aren't, they're neither have their foot in the government side or in the private sector side. And then you layer into things like privacy at the sensor, you layer in things like local domain control of the data in terms of it's not getting moved into a cloud, it's not passing through a bunch of third-party POPs and jump points when you're moving it, you know, from place to place. It stays local, stays within those jurisdictions.
Stays sovereign.
Yeah. Sovereign.
So the way I equate this too is if you think about historically, I had to convince VCs back in 1994 that these things called data centers were going to be a thing. They had to invest, and because every data set was in the mainframe. You think about it, everything was in the mainframe, and then over the last, that it took about 20 years for us to really see that swing out to the edge. I mean, to all PCs and all these data centers that we have now. Over the last 10 years, though, we saw everything vacuum back up into these monster equivalent of a mainframe. While what we're seeing is we have, Pat's, people like Michael Dell and, Pat, the CEO of Intel, and Charlie Ergen all say, we're gonna see the pendulum swing, or the, where the puck's going is to the edge super, super fast. And that's gonna allow us to regain control of the data. And you think about Tim Berners-Lee has a product called Solid and a company called Interrupt. We're not gonna be able to do it at the cloud. The cloud is too, it's a fortress. There's no way you're gonna do it at that data set. But if we can do it at where the new data gravity is going to be created, where the new data creation exists, you can. And the whole goal there is not for it to be a corporation that owns the data, like it is now, not for the government, because then it's open records, but for it to be a P3 that allows that, hopefully Goldilocks, but it's gonna have challenges. I mean, nothing's gonna be perfect, but this is where people like you getting involved, even with the Autonomy Institute, and helping address those challenges will be beneficial.
And then that entity governs it ongoing too. If there are questions that come up in the future or potential revenue applications, the decisions are made by that P3 going forward.
Okay, so I find it interesting that you brought up the example of the Roomba, because I kind of think we're all Roombas, right?
The quote of the day.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And built the map over the years based on traffic patterns that are fairly anonymous. Can we not just take that data set that is fairly real time and overlay it with GIS to build a core product from which now we add the additional sensors? And one of the ways that I looked at this, and it was really important, a couple of weeks ago, one of the first researchers to determine that train was being attacked was actually looking at traffic data and saw a 40-mile-long traffic jam surge just outside of the train. And it was the first indicator that we had that those troops on the road were starting to move because they were all carrying cell phones.
Yep.
So how do we unlock that data? Because I think we can not pretty easily, but how do we unlock that data to provide value out of, instead of starting with data now, we have 10 years worth of data so that we can predict traffic patterns?
I think that becomes part of the toolkit, right? Where we're talking about the federated data, and that becomes an extra layer that can be fed into, improved algorithms, whatever data sets that we're, so we think that has a place, very much so, in a digital twin, a city scale digital twin, because obviously the historical traffic patterns, but just really real time, because again, going back to the privacy aspects of it, there's a certain amount of anonymizing that needs to go on. But I think that's a piece of the puzzle.
And this is, so what company? Are you with a company?
Army Futures Command.
I'm with Army
Futures. Oh, Arts. Yes. Okay. No, I directly. So to that point also, what the public-private partnership allows is, like, Google does not want to share that data necessarily openly. Right now they do relationships with governments to monetize that. What a P3 allows them to do is be part of that monetization. Because if they give it to the city, it really can't be monetized past that. If they give it to a P3, that P3 can then continue to pay dividends back to them over time. And another example is like the engineering companies. Like right now, our public safety responders are going to all the cities and trying to create a digital twin of all of our buildings. If we were just able to get the engineering companies to basically submit their BIM models into the digital twin, we would have incredible data sets that allows the first responder to get to the right floor at the right level at the right time. But they're not going to want, they don't want to share the data. But if it's part of a P3 where it can be monetized and they can actually constrain who gets to see that data, it's a win-win.
And even with that, I'm a Roomba, you're a Roomba, you walk around our office.
Yeah, exactly. Agreed.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, so there's a long story about that, but I'll make it really brief. So there's a big challenge. So a P3 for this type of infrastructure has really never been done anywhere in the United States. It's been done in Singapore and in other, you know, countries. So Austin happens to be the furthest down the path of that collaboration because it takes multiple city departments, multiple commissioners, multiple judges, and a lot of collaboration from outside partners on the private side. And the process has been going on for actually a little over 3 years, and we're now at the point where a lot of the process is in place. Now it's how can a $160 million check from private be brought into the city to help deploy this? And believe it or not, it's actually very challenging to push something into the city that the city hasn't paid for with taxes. So I think we're still a couple quarters away to finally solving that whole equation, but we see the digital twin being the first step of that, because the digital twin can be done with less constraints, seeing that we're not talking about a large check having to be written. But it's a process.
I want to elaborate a little bit. Has there been talk about how to structure charges for use of the digital twin? I'm going to be torturing the analogy about the interstate highways. If you think about the interstate highways, the way we fund them does not align with the way the economy is extracted out of those. You know, we fund mainly out of the gas tax and then the oil taxes that come in and there are global taxes and all of the externalities that are generated that are never even accounted for. But the net is that we can produce a whole lot more with the interstate highway system, but it also redistributes wealth. It's
yep.
mainly for poorer people, richer people, if you really break it all out. I kind of think there's an analogy here where there's an opportunity and also danger. An opportunity where if you structure charges for use of the digital city properly, you might be able to address a lot of these social and equity issues. Maybe I think you were kind of alluding to that point about it earlier. But it sounds like you're creating gigantic new commons. And
yep.
there's a danger here where if that became privatized, or the value being extracted is privatized by a few, you know, market bullies, then, you know, that's not, you know, it'll probably help us on, but it'll also create other problems. It seems like there's an enormous opportunity here, properly, if you properly structure the charges for how people access the, you know, the data that they're building, that you can do a lot of positive good with it.
So, yeah, and I would add to that in that part of the value creation, when we're talking about monetization, we're also talking about savings, cost savings for the city. And this is one of the promises of smart city integration, is that being able to, through a digital twin, through the modeling of this, allows for more efficient use of resources by the city. So when it comes to, you know, monetization of the data, it works both ways as far as cutting costs versus driving new revenues. So to talk to your point a bit about, you know, the way the federal highway system is the cost of it and the way we pay for it are really kind of divorced, and we come up with this kind of odd system. I think that's a very valid point as far as the way these things need to be structured and how the monetization actually operates is something to be kind of discussed and analyzed to really come up with a
so
optimism.
Yeah. So, imagine if you had incentives, say, that made it such that the big guys who come in, like, you know, the big players are going to want access to data. You make them pay in a way that makes sense to the small players.
Well, I think the primary currency in this actually becomes the data itself.
Yeah,
So when you're talking about contributions of data versus what data you get back, and then there would be different levels. So the detailed data that maybe is contributed, what comes back is not necessarily detailed data in exchange, but maybe insights and different processed data that comes out from that.
You think about the data. So right now, every single state's really now concerned about the gas tax, because the gas tax is fundamentally what we pay for our roadways and make sure that they're maintained, the bridges. And gas tax is continuing to go down. I mean, cars have become more efficient over time, no matter what. But now the electrification is taking place. So the gas tax is going to even plummet further. So what are you going to replace that with? So they're now looking at things like the digital twin being the mechanism to allow us to track and have vehicle miles traveled. But it also then allows them to have a clear subsidies in places where they can stratify who uses the roads and the difference. Because once you have a digital twin, you can do all kinds of different mechanisms to incentivize and to basically better support the community. But like you have, you know, New York, you know, if they have, you know, 8 lanes, you know, they have 6 lanes dedicated going in, and then of course 6 to go out as they switch over in the evening. With all this new infrastructure, that is able to be done in far more situations than just you know, tunnels and bridges.
One other quick question for you. Unintended consequences.
Yeah.
Because you had a lot of discussion about that, and then you talked about all the things you could do with this, and that really it will be enabled. But I think about coming back to interstate highways. I mean, would you not know that there's a ton of things that happen because of interstate highways that nobody ever thought about in 1954?
Yeah.
Yeah, the suburbanization took off much, well, I've already started, but it took off much faster than we ever did. Without the interstates, you have the environmental issues.
Yeah. So think about it. It's pretty exciting to know that state of Texas, Frank Turner, is the one that engineered the interstate highways. So what's exciting is Texas has the opportunity to step up again. And I think where I had no idea 3 years ago the scars that interstate highways put across our country. It's staggering once you see the maps and look at the yellow book. But I would say that where the last major build out in our society was interstate highways, created all these scars. This intelligent infrastructure does the exact opposite. It's about building community. And that's what really resonates with the federal agencies we've been working with. And as far as unintended consequences, I think that's going to be a challenge, but I think we have time to work that out, because we now know the trend. You know, the data is the trend, and data went from mainframe to PCs and to the edge and then back to the cloud. What our goal in this process is make sure, if data is new oil, how do we effectively, in this new process, put the process procedures and P3s in place to make sure that data serves us as a community versus just gets sucked back into a giant monopoly again.
And it seems like we have that connection within there, us as a community, truly all of us.
Yeah, exactly.
I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on privacy as a sensor. Just give a bit of context. Spectrus was a sensor team was working with AR cloud companies that were, you know, developing scans that were camera based, looking at one cloud and pushing them together. And both the way we were off the content use spatially, but given permissions. And I built out a way to bake in permissions to the localization within the camera system. When it comes to LiDAR and other sensor technology, we've been fuzzy on that. So if we could discuss the standards we put in place from a technology spec perspective that would, you know, our privacy preserving. And on top of that, we discuss the privacy aspects of having a human in the loop. So a lot of the AR cloud companies are building out their scans. State Technologies is one example, and they sold to Facebook. They had to have people that were developing not only, you know, machine learning algorithms to do some of the cleanup for them and privacy and preserving cleanup, but also manually going in and moving certain anomalous clouds and things like that. Even when you go to the Google say I want to remove my house, you know, I want to put out my house or something like that, I want to Google Safety. It takes a while, and you know, that's the manual process of trying to discuss some of that aspects of privacy data standards.
And are you still doing that type of research now in the development? We'd love to talk, because there's a lot of challenges. There's a lot of things that have already been done over the last 20 years that, in fact, Google had to solve a lot. Google Street View, as an example, they had to find ways to remove all personal identifiable data. Now there's actually cameras and systems that don't even record that data. They're designed, you know, from the manufacturer where, as much as you like to, it just doesn't actually record it to the hard drive. But privacy at the sensor, what we're meaning is there's going to be a lot more sensors that have to be deployed, not necessarily ones that are like cameras, but, you know, LIDARs and digital radars. And the goal is to take that data and only extract out, nobody's going to know what this means, but ASTRIC is the standard that was developed for radars to be used in the aviation industry. And it's a standard that only passes to airplanes the blips on the radar that they need to be concerned about. Otherwise, everything else is gone. And that's the goal with this, is the sensors only extracting out what needs to be shared to the pedestrian, to the cars and the rovers that are driving around the city. But it's not a done. I mean, this is why we're pushing so hard to get the R&D between DoD and industry, is because those hard challenges have to be solved together.
Especially our machine learning algorithms and the design that you mentioned to automatically look out like license plates and faces and things like that. They're not always perfect.
Yeah.
And sometimes you do have to have human beings go in. So do you see in the P3, partnerships that, it's a contracted third party that would do that?
Have to be. Yes.
Okay. And so, like, what would that privacy policy look like?
It goes back to his comment about, if you've seen one P3, you've seen one P3. So like in most Texas, we're gonna be super, super privacy sensitive about how data is used, and whoever is that contractor that might be doing that for a P3 in the city of Austin is gonna have to have very stringent rules to follow. And it might be where they actually have to be working at the facility that actually is controlling the infrastructure itself, so it doesn't go to a cloud or anywhere else. But when you go to absolutely. In fact, what's good is we have local Icon is actually looking at even printing SCIFs now, so it's pretty exciting to see what innovation can be done these days.
Yeah. Tech innovation, creative space, and so for years, we were talking about emergency responders, emergency responders who go through like Dungeons and Dragons kind of like cycles of like, James has down here, he's close to the dirty bomb, and then spraying people over there. So we're using dynamic data provided by the cloud, Google Spot, specifically to try to determine randomness, so to speak. But with smart cities going in the future, I remember being at a Bloomberg conference in Singapore where we were talking about megacities, right? And the idea that Singapore not being one, but being in the future, but looking at like the Tokyos of the world where there's a wealth of information on the people, and then, of course, all the money data that you probably capture that is computer because of the technologies like 5G and so on and so forth. My curiosity is, in order for it to make it kind of safe, because I love the Roomba example of where everyone's Roomba, what is being explored right now for protected and said data in terms of, have you been looking at blockchain and NFTs in this case? I'll bring up NFTs because it's
Concern
for arts, but the idea of a contract, towns and cities, because we could think about infrastructure being utilized. So, for example, Thomas Carr, Oxford City, they're benefiting from that city's information being provided. Maybe there's like a tax kickback, so to speak, for that city because they wrote the contract and it's NFTs.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about what is being explored in that space.
A tremendous amount, and we'd love to talk. So we have talked to quite a few of the different blockchain systems at the edge, that or ledger systems that basically allow the data, to be immutable. I mean, because what's key is being able to demonstrate that data can't be manipulated after the fact, and blockchain is a good way of doing that. Funny you mentioned NFTs, because one of the use cases that came to us from the city is retailers were talking about, hey, if we have a digital twin of our retail shop and someone sees something they really like, can they just buy an NFT of the thing that they can't actually afford, but actually have an NFT and actually walk out of the store with it? So it's crazy ideas that are coming about with the digital twin, but once you have the infrastructure, things like the blockchain, the ledger can take place, securing data can take place, and isolating where that data can actually traverse, where it's not just being part of a big monolithic cloud.
Right, because I think ownership is the future, obviously.
Yep.
Centralize everybody, talk about servers, that's being centralized by the big corporations, but we're talking about a future where all of a sudden you're going to have these communities transition to you and you don't need that, which also means, I think of like HOAs and stuff like that.
Yep.
Some kind of
Yeah. Thank you. One more question. I think we're getting very close. No, it's good. Please. Yeah. This is great.
Yeah. I work with the Hong Kong Impact Data Consortium. It's essentially a digital twin for the social services, national social services in Hong Kong. We also work in developing countries, and we also are working with blockchain. We're working with the ICSA protocol and the Cosmos. Build a lot of our infrastructure. Working in a country like Hong Kong, it's very data and digital literate. So doing the PPP program is easy, but we're also expanding into other parts of Southeast Asia. And I'm just curious, where these countries are a lot, less data literate. And I'm just wondering, I understand all these great incentives like profit sharing and all this kind of stuff, but that's great good savings. But in your experience, structuring these PPPs, what would you say would be kind of like the main thresholds that you have to overcome to convince governments, or likewise the private sector, actually form one of these PPPs, especially in our case, in developing countries where they don't clearly, it's like in Hong Kong, we got it done in a few months, but in places like Laos, Myanmar, Papua New Guinea, all these kinds of countries where they don't quite see all the dots connected, what would you say would be a good starting point to overcome this so that we can bring this to the rest of the global south?
That's a great question, because I think one of the key elements of all of this has to do with the fact that the United States has very strong property rights. And that in and of itself is what makes a P3 structure viable. So when it comes to Southeast Asia, particularly countries like Myanmar, a very well-developed set of property rights and a rule of law in particular are what makes it possible to put these boundaries up between the public, the private, and incorporate kind of hybrid versions of that. So I would say that the things to be looking at are what are the particular kinds of institutions or entities that can maintain their own property rights in those jurisdictions would be the key starting point for figuring out how to structure something.
And one group, so Rockefeller started a group called Co-Develop, because here in Texas, as an example, the governor really wanted that this intelligent infrastructure, it's not just about the cities, it's about the rural communities. So the rural community in Texas is very similar to the situation you're talking about. And we go into those and look at, okay, if we put intelligent infrastructure down this highway going through these cities, how can it then help solve the digital divide, like broadband in those communities? How can it actually allow additional sensors to be deployed? So the manufacturing, they might have chemical manufacturing or tractor manufacturing in that. How can automation allow them to rapidly get those from the those distribution facilities to the port? So you look across a number of industries, a number of use cases to then show the economic return on the P3 itself. Go.
Thank you so much for coming. Last thing is, again, this is the beginning of a very rich conversation. We'll be back in 6 weeks at the Intelligent Infrastructure Conference, and we're writing and creating quite a lot of content. So to follow us, EdgeX, an Autonomy Institute on our LinkedIn, and keep up with the conversation. We want you to contribute to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.